Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, September 12, 2016. What is more deplorable? The basket comments that Hillary made at a fundraiser on Friday night? Or the obvious cover-up of serious health issues brought forward at the 9/11 memorial session on Sunday? Well, one person's deplorable is another person's fabulous, I suppose. But it was quite a weekend for Hillary Rodham Clinton, and certainly didn't work out the way she had expected. And I don't know if you've had a chance to see the footage yet, but a citizen cam captured her as she left the 9/11 memorial proceedings, saying that she had overheated. And it was humid, but 82 degrees, so it's hard to know exactly what got her overheated. But what is deeply troubling is when you look at the video footage, despite the effort of Secret Service and other aides to form a human shield to prevent us from seeing this, Hillary Clinton couldn't walk. She appeared to be conscious. She was standing up, being steadied by a female associate. When she started to lurch forward, her feet failed under her. The term buckled was used in some news accounts. And she, you know, really was essentially heaved into this van that had been pulled up. And this was all done very quickly when she decided she had to leave the scene there. And then 90 minutes later, she strolls out from Chelsea's apartment, where she had been dropped off. And she's speaking normally. She's walking under her own power. There's nobody near her to assist her. She's sure-footed. She says hello to a little kid. And so it is truly bizarre. I mean, you have to ask, what did she get at Chelsea's apartment that revived her so miraculously? And was it the pneumonia diagnosis that was belatedly announced hours later that caused this scene that was captured on video? Now, I have commented a couple of times about the issues that have been raised by the Trump campaign and surrogates about Hillary's health. And I have mostly noted the ferocious denials that have come from Team Clinton and echoed through the mouthpieces at MSDNC. And I figured if they're so busy trying to debunk these rumors, there might be something to them. And so I want to thank a couple of my correspondents who have sent me links to some of these videos. I've looked at them. Some of them I think are silly, where she took a hand from somebody or an arm to help get up some steps that were iced over. But then a week ago in Ohio, she had that four-minute coughing fit that was captured on video, and I don't understand why she kept the microphone up there and kept coughing into it. She should have said, "I'm going to take a break, folks. I'll be back in a minute when I get this cough jag out of the way." And the bottom line here is now we know about this pneumonia diagnosis. That could be the extent of her medical issues. We're told there are no other secrets. But why did they keep this secret? This is another self-inflicted wound against Hillary's most vulnerable traits, honesty and trustworthiness. The campaign knew on Friday, or at least somebody did. And they sat on it for Saturday, they sat on it for Sunday, until it was so embarrassing and the silence was deafening. And they finally trotted Mrs. Clinton's doctor out. Her name is Lisa Bardack. She said Secretary Clinton has been experiencing a cough related to allergies. On Friday morning, after a prolonged cough, she was given a diagnosis of pneumonia. She was put on antibiotics and advised to rest and modify her schedule. And she has canceled a fundraising trip she was due in the Bay Area tonight and tomorrow to scoop up cash from Silicon Valley millionaires. But what's also interesting is that most of the headlines don't refer to the specifics of what happened. They say she didn't feel well. They say she stumbled. But this really was a very serious situation where it appeared that her motor nervous system was not working below the waist. And sure, I've heard the rumors coming from the other side that this could be Parkinson's or something more serious. And again, all they have to do is be honest. Unless, of course, there is something worse that they are hiding. And it is this furtive behavior, this cover-up mentality, that is the normal reaction for a Clinton, that digs her deeper and deeper into a swamp of her own creation. And when you include this with the self-inflicted wounds of the Clinton Foundation, her failure to be forthcoming by releasing the Wall Street speeches, the list goes on and on. Now, we're told that if you raise questions about this, you must be a sexist or some sort of a Trump lover who hates America, hates liberals. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just cacophony. There are rumors that the DNC, whoever runs it these days, I guess it's Donna Brazile, may be holding meetings to discuss a Plan B. Would Plan B be for Bernie? I don't know. So here's a euphemized description. Clinton was filmed losing her footing and being assisted into a waiting van. That's from The Guardian, and that's not an honest description of what I saw. And so the campaign admits that they blew this one. We could have done better yesterday, wrote Jennifer Palmieri, a communications director. But look at this comment that came from David Axelrod, Obama's former campaign manager. Antibiotics can take care of pneumonia. What's the cure for an unhealthy penchant for privacy that repeatedly creates unnecessary problems? So if you're offended by me raising this, just listen to what David Axelrod, a loyal Democrat committed to the election of Hillary Clinton, had to say about it. Oh, and I feel better because Donald Trump is going to share his health details with Dr. Oz on Thursday night. You know, Trump is just so committed to television, to the audience that he can reach and manipulate and lie to. And, you know, you've seen Dr. Bornstein, this weird guy who wrote the laughable health review letter for Trump while a limo waited outside his office to pick it up. And I don't know, I don't have much confidence in Dr. Oz. I've watched his show a couple of times, and I think he's just a huckster. I would imagine he got his medical degree at Trump University. And maybe that's why the Donald is going to share the details with him. So it was Friday night at a fundraiser in New York City, and this is one of the few that the Clinton campaign allowed media to attend. Most of them are completely walled off. There isn't even a pool reporter who gets to go in and see who's there and then escort it out before any comments are made. No. The fundraisers are completely private. And so the press was there to hear her say that, I'll get to the quote in a second. In her apology the next day, she said, "Last night I was grossly generalistic, and that's never a good idea. I regret saying half. That was wrong." All right? So with those apologies in mind, here's what she said. And I'm uncomfortable with the phrase grossly generalistic, but it's hers, not mine. She said, "You know, to be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables, right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. And unfortunately, there are people like that, and he has lifted them up. He's given voice to their website that used to only have 11,000 people, now 11 million. I don't know if that's Breitbart or what she's referring to. He tweets and retweets their offensive, hateful, mean-spirited rhetoric. Now, some of those folks, they're irredeemable. But thankfully, they are not America. Now, I want to be fair here because she went on to describe another basket of people who support Trump because they feel that the government has let them down, the economy's let them down, nobody cares about them, nobody worries. These are the people we have to understand and empathize with as well. So I don't think she realized that the first part would be the soundbite and that it comes off sounding like Mitt Romney's dismissal of 47% of the people who could never vote for him back in 2012. And I happen to agree with what Hillary Clinton is saying. But it is a double standard. And I'm not applying a sexist label here. But there is a double standard because Trump is encouraged to be politically incorrect, to say outrageous things over and over again. And he has picked up on this, and he's saying, look how she insults my voters. And so it isn't fair, I want to be clear, to suddenly impose political correctness on Hillary Clinton and say, she never should have said something like that. Now, I do think that, unfortunately, this is a cudgel that she has created that will be used against her. But I've linked to Charles M. Blow's op-ed column at the New York Times so that you can see as he lists the data. Nearly half of Trump supporters describe African Americans as more violent than whites. 65% of Republicans think the next president should speak bluntly, even if critical of Islam. 80% of likely Trump voters supported Trump's proposed ban on Muslims. 62% supported creating a national database of Muslims. 40% supported shutting down mosques in the United States. So whether you want to put them in a basket, whether you want to call them deplorables or horribles or whatever, I think it's fair to say, and you know I'm not a supporter of Hillary Clinton, but I think that she understated it's more than half. That basket is overflowing. And so I guess the response to this will be, okay, that does it. No more media at fundraisers. We can't have this kind of disclosure. Well, over the weekend, a lot of people that I know and respect gathered at the Cooper Union for the focus, the event called Justice in Focus. And some of the people who appeared on my 9/11 interview special that we released last Friday, Richard Gage, Professor Graham McQueen, and a number of others, Mark Crispin Miller, a longtime contributor to this program, he emceed the events at Cooper Union over the weekend. And it's really stunning to see the way the media reacts. And I'm open to what Vice News does. Shane Smith is a rising star in the media world. They've got a nightly show that HBO, a nightly news report HBO is going to start broadcasting here in September. My friend Jason Leopold does great work at Vice News. At the same time, if you don't go to the news.vice.com, you just go to vice.com, you get a lot of lifestyle reporting about sex and drugs and a lot of pandering bullshit. So that's my mixed thumbnail review of Vice News. So on 9/11, the headline reads, 9/11 truthers vow to never ever forget. And then Alex Thompson, who wrote this piece, opens by saying, the theories go like this. The U.S. government plotted to bring down the Twin Towers on 9/11. ISIS leader is not an Islamic terrorist, but actually an asset of the U.S. military, trained at Camp Buka. Ted Cruz's father really was with Oswald before the JFK assassination. Now, I spent a little time watching the live stream from Cooper Union over the weekend. I didn't hear anything about Ted Cruz and Oswald. I didn't hear anything about Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. I heard people talking about the lies that are the basis of the myth of 9/11. and how they don't square with the physics, with the science, and with the physical evidence. And so in this case, Vice News is using the tactics of the New York Times and all the corporate media. They only report on events like this for the purpose of ridiculing them. And this article is loaded with snark. Despite 15 years of derision and dismissal from politicians, it says, the media and most of the American public, the eclectic following soldiers on. Mockery is just further evidence of a conspiracy. And so, when I see so many people who are ignorant, and they display that ignorance with pride, and they revel in putting down those of us who are courageous enough and independent thinkers enough, willing to challenge the consensus narrative, which is jammed on us by our government and our media. Well, the guy's right in one respect. If you make fun of me for this, it doesn't mean that I'm going to go slip into the corner and suck my thumb. I will continue to report on wherever the facts lead me. And I want to credit Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate, for issuing a statement yesterday calling for a new investigation into 9/11. It's a long statement. I won't read all of it, but it's balanced where they talk about the loss of life. We honor the victims and the first responders. The Stein-Baraka campaign stands for truth and transparency. The Green Party objected to the idea of responding to the attacks with war. We now know, I'm quoting, with absolute certainty that fraudulent claims of weapons of mass destruction and links between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda were used as pretext to invade Iraq. The September 11 attacks were used to launch a war against terrorism, yet terrorism has soared worldwide. This war has been used as an excuse to squash civil liberties and scapegoat Muslims and other immigrants. It is well known that the 9/11 Commission produced a report containing so many omissions and distortions that Harper's Magazine described it as a whitewash as public service, a document that defrauds the nation. The co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission wrote a book just 2 years after the report saying, "We were set up to fail." The Stein-Baraka campaign believes a new inquiry is necessary. Under our administration, a new inquiry would have access to the considerable body of responsible, independent research that has emerged over the last 15 years. We would create an independent 9/11 commission, not one dominated by members with an interest in protecting the reputation and careers of foreign affairs and intelligence communities. Well, I salute you. That is the right way to honor the lives lost on September 11th, 2001. That same Jill Stein has her name on a warrant for her arrest issued in North Dakota because she went to the scene of the protests over the Dakota Pipeline Project and used a can of spray paint to tag a bulldozer. And once again, I think Jill Stein is on the right side of an issue. She's the only presidential candidate who's said anything about the battle over the Dakota Access Pipeline. And after a court ruling, which I reported on Friday, dealt a setback to the protesters, including the Native Americans there, in a Friday afternoon surprise, usually Friday afternoon is when they take actions they don't want you to know about. Well, the surprise was this was one of those Friday afternoon moves that actually was in the right direction, because behind the scenes, the Obama White House organized the Department of Justice, the Interior Department, and the Army Corps of Engineers. And to the extent possible, they issued orders to stop the pipeline destruction, construction. Interesting slip there, Peter. And this may not hold. I am open-minded about this, but I remain skeptical that this could just be a diversionary tactic by the Obama administration to try to dissipate the protest. But the government also urged the company building the pipeline to voluntarily pause all construction for 40 miles around Lake Oahe. So it remains to be seen how sincere this effort is. But I'll take this as better than a poke in the eye, better than the court ruling that did nothing for the protesters, and we'll see how it plays out. Also late on Friday, we learned that John Kerry, our Secretary of State, and his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, after meeting in Geneva, Switzerland for weeks, have negotiated a kind of ceasefire in Syria. And I say kind of because there's so many carve-outs that it's hard to imagine that it is sustainable. But it is better than nothing, and I applaud the efforts at diplomacy. They're not pure diplomacy because they're linked to a proposed partnership between the U.S. and Russia for military action to take out the Islamic State. And the news accounts today indicate that within an hour of the implementation of this shaky ceasefire, that it was broken. Violations were reported within an hour. Several residents in Aleppo said that a government helicopter had dropped explosive cylinders in a rebel-held district. And in the southern province of Daraa, a rebel faction said that it had killed four government soldiers. Now, this is supposed to be a quiet period followed in a week by a new collaboration of airstrikes against jihadist militants in Syria in this partnership between the U.S. and Russia. Now, this requires the U.S. to put aside its demand that the Assad government be removed. And I consider that to be progress. But the idea that we're going to have a ceasefire and then replace it with new assaults, driven by the interests of the United States and Russia, well, I'm not sure that's going to lead to any kind of sustainable end to the conflict. And over the weekend, in advance of this expected ceasefire, there were hundreds of people killed as people jockeyed for position in advance of a possible truce. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And over the weekend, I dropped by my P.O. box, where some people send checks. And like clockwork, Paul Elsesser, my most staunch subscriber, had his monthly check there. Thank you, Paul. And then a couple of surprises, like this one from Mitchell Kaddish. I've been listening to your show for 2 years. The content you present is important, relevant, enlightening, insightful, and interesting. Well, thank you, Mitchell. I have to admit, it confirms my worldview. Well, we all need that. I'm rooting for you to successfully influence a wide audience. We need more journalists like yourself. And so he sent a check for $100 for a 2-year subscription. Thank you very much, Mitchell. I appreciate that. And then here's a note from a guy named Pete who prefers not to be fully identified. And he challenged me to pronounce his last name, which I'm not going to attempt. But he said, no need to say my name. I'm a longtime listener, just coming back from some time off. And he kicked in $200. Pete, thank you very, very much. I appreciate the support that people show me. And if you'd like to join in, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click the menu button. It pulls down. You click Become a Subscriber. Takes you to the sign-up page where it's easy as pie. And I have an announcement of a bonus book. I only have one copy of this. But today I'm releasing to my subscribers an important new interview with Andrew Bacevich. He retired from the Army as a colonel. He taught history at Boston University. And his new book is a really important analysis of the long arc of America's War for the Greater Middle East. That's the title of the book, America's War for the Greater Middle East. And here's an excerpt from my conversation with Andrew Bacevich.
Nobody asks Trump or Clinton, what's your plan for peace? What is your plan that will enable the United States to bring the troops home, to no longer be in the business of continually bombing somebody or assassinating some militant leader, to bring things to a conclusion? Now, back in the Cold War, a struggle that in many respects we didn't think would ever end, notwithstanding that fact, presidents or people who aspired to become president routinely made references to peace as the ultimate objective of U.S. policy. Now, perhaps they were being cynical. I don't know. It's hard to look into their hearts. But the prospect of peace out there somewhere figured as a fundamental objective of U.S. policy.
Andrew Bacevich is a veteran and historian, and he lost his son, Andrew Jr., who died in combat in Iraq. He knows a lot of what he's talking about, and I recommend his new book. As I mentioned, I have one extra copy that the publisher sent me. And if you take out a new annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., you're the first person to request the Bacevich book. I will be happy to send it to you. So sign up today at peterbcollins.com. And while we're talking about subscriptions and money and stuff like that, I got an SOS from Roger Schuler earlier today. And they are on real hard times trying to eke out a living in Missouri. And Roger maintains reporting at his blog, legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. And they live week to week in a cheap motel. And it's not a pretty life, but they're very much on the edge. And so if you're able to help out at this point, I'll put up the link to Legal Schnauzer in the show file for this podcast. And there is a PayPal button prominently displayed at the top of the Legal Schnauzer blog. Well, I am reading with great fascination this series that's been launched by The Guardian newspaper based on information from Dan Jones. Daniel Jones was the top investigator for the Senate Intelligence Committee into the CIA's torture efforts. And in the Guardian series, I read the second installment today. It is fascinating to see what was going on behind the scenes. And our friend and colleague that I referred to a few minutes ago when I was trashing Vice News, Jason Leopold, figures prominently in this coverage because of his efforts to cover the torture report, cover John Brennan's apology to Dianne Feinstein, which was never mailed, that the CIA inadvertently released to Leopold. And what the Guardian report shows is that there was a great effort to kill the Senate Intelligence Report on CIA torture, even after it was shown that the CIA unlawfully interfered, breached its own security agreements with the Senate staffers over the fight over the Panetta Review. And it's Jason Leopold who first tipped us off to the Panetta Review. This was an in-house review of torture that unfortunately exposed many of the things that the Feinstein report did as well. So there was a struggle over it. It was really ugly. And when it all is shaken out, what you learn is that Barack Obama and his White House worked to squelch the Senate report. At almost every stage, they provided obstructions. They favored the CIA in the dispute over the Panetta Review, and then when it was time for it to be released, they rolled out John Kerry, an old colleague of Senator Feinstein, and tried to get him to say, oh gosh, can't you just delay this? And that was a ruse, because if it had been delayed into January of 2015, the Republicans, who then took control of the Senate, would have blocked its release. So get this, the Obama White House was colluding with Republicans to delay the report so Republicans could kill it for the Obama White House. It's really stinky. I've linked to this lengthy report, and I encourage you to read it when you have the time. It's really telling. It includes a struggle over trying to honestly reveal that some of the torturers, who were used by the CIA, had ugly backgrounds with workplace anger management issues, domestic violence, and sexual assault. And the CIA went to great lengths to try to get that removed from the report, again, with the support of the Obama White House. And the article tells us that Dan Jones believed that he was about to lose this struggle. The White House was about to prevail. when James Clapper, the top spook, the proven perjurer who still has his job? He issued a statement that essentially turned the committee members in the other direction. It was so insulting to them that he was trying to mislead them with a document that was riddled with factual errors. And it is that move that apparently led to the ultimate release of the redacted executive summary of the Feinstein torture review. I'm also linking, I couldn't find an active link over at Foreign Policy because they want everybody to buy a subscription. But if you do an internet search for James Bamford Foreign Policy and Obama Surveillance, something like that, this article should pop up. It was published on September 7th, and I just caught up with it. And Bamford explains how this summer we launched the newest spy satellite called Advanced Orion. And he describes that as kind of an iconic tribute to President Obama as his administration entered its last 6 months in the White House. Over his two terms, quote, Obama has created the most powerful surveillance state the world has ever seen. While other leaders may have created more oppressive spying regimes, none has come close to constructing one of equivalent size, breadth, cost, and intrusiveness. The effort to wire the world or to achieve extreme reach has cost American taxpayers more than $100 billion. Obama has justified the gargantuan expense by arguing that there are some trade-offs involved in keeping our country safe. And Bamford is very dogged in evaluating, on his own terms, Obama's expansion and regularization of massive surveillance operations. And like Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe, whom I interviewed a few weeks ago, Bamford is concerned that the NSA is drowning in data. They're so determined to collect it all that they can't process it. And they repeatedly miss things that could have come up in the surveillance. So I want you to read this. It's extremely well written. It goes through quite a few chapters of Obama's administration related to surveillance. I think every American needs to know about this. Also, I want to commend Sam Biddle at The Intercept. He got his hands on the latest manuals for Harris Corporation's Stingray surveillance box and its stablemates. There are a bunch of them that fall under the Stingray generic label. And he quotes Richard Tynan with Privacy International, saying that these devices with powerful capabilities threaten civil liberties, communications infrastructure, and potentially national security. And they go on to publish some screenshots of the manuals so that you get an idea about how these systems work. The ease with which Stingray can be used is quite striking, and there do not seem to be any technical safeguards against misuse. It allows the operator to configure virtually every aspect of the operation of the fake cell tower, and it forces all the phones within its range to check in and disgorge all kinds of information. That information is then collected in the Stingray hard drive, and we're told that if you're not a suspect, it's immediately destroyed. Only that's not true. We're also told that these manuals have to be kept secret because they could harm the competitive interests of Harris Corporation and that criminals and terrorists would have access to information to allow them to build countermeasures. But over at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, lawyer Jennifer Lynch said, I'm not aware of any case in which a police agency has used a cell site simulator to find a terrorist. They're mostly used to trap pot dealers and other low-level criminals. So this is another stunning exposure of the program that has flourished under Obama. And I connect it to the Bamford indictment. Check it out. It's important information. We learned over the weekend that Chelsea Manning has begun a hunger strike at Fort Leavenworth. Quote, I need help. I'm not getting any. I was driven to suicide by the lack of care for my gender dysphoria that I've been desperate for. I didn't get any. I still haven't gotten any. And so Manning has said that she will not willingly consume any food or drink except water and prescribed medications. She is refusing to voluntarily cut or shorten her hair in any way. And basically, they've been forcing her to submit to masculine haircuts that she doesn't want. And as a result of her suicide attempt back near the 4th of July, Manning has been subject to retaliation and isolation, which is the last thing I think that she needs or deserves. She also signed a do not resuscitate letter and submitted it to the prison's medical team, and she's trying to prevent any attempt to force feed her or revive her should her hunger strike threaten her life. And finally here, I am buoyed to see an action by 25 feminist organizations who have sent a letter to California Governor Jerry Brown urging him to veto a bill that would impose mandatory minimum sentences on sexual assault. And this case comes out of the Brock Turner case. He's the Stanford swimmer who got off with an incredibly light sentence. And he, of course, had sexually penetrated with his finger a drunk female. That was the sex crime that he committed. It is a sex crime, but it's not as serious as a violent forced copulation. And this has been hard to discuss in the emotional firestorm that surfaced after his lenient sentence. And I understand why people are pissed off about that. And I take all sexual assault very seriously, but we need to be sure that the penalty fits the crime and that, for example, a forcible, non-consensual rape of a drunk person is worse than fondling or digital penetration. And many people who have zero tolerance say, I don't want to hear that. There's no proportionality here. It's all wrong, and it all should be punished with a maximum sentence that the judge doesn't get to decide. It's decided by the law. And I'm fundamentally opposed to minimum mandatory sentences, and I am pleasantly shocked to see feminist groups stand up. The letter says, we know firsthand that the consequences of rape are no less damaging for a victim who is unconscious than for a victim who is not. We also know that mandatory minimum laws are harmful, a harmful, mistaken solution to our rightful anger over the Brock Turner case and many others like it. So, I've been kind of biting my tongue because I know that in the middle of an emotional reaction like this, rational thinking is not too likely. But I give credit. Here's Michelle Anderson, Dean of Brooklyn College. Mandatory minimums have not worked in response to the challenges posed by drugs in our society. They have not worked in response to challenges posed by other kinds of crime. There is no reason that mandatory minimums would work as a response to the real problem of sexual assault. I oppose the legislation, Anderson added. I hope Brown does veto it. I think we have a history in this country of overreacting and overusing the criminal justice system. Feminists have been saying for years that mandatory punishments are not the right response to sexual violence. I'm really delighted to see rational thinking come into a very emotional debate. Thanks for listening to my News and Comment podcast. It's free, and it's now available on YouTube with our handy new, easy-to-remember URL.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.